On this episode of Baseball Bar, because we react to the humongous news that Artie Moreno is selling the Los Angeles Angels to Stan Kroenke. Oh my goodness, what a development in Orange County. Then we welcome in Ryan Spielborgs, who you can find on the Apple TV broadcast this Friday. And guess what? You can also find us this Friday. We're doing an alt cast for Tigers Guardians on Apple TV. More details coming up on this episode. And finally, we, of course, talk about September call-ups. Rosters have expanded. Who should you be keeping an eye on over this final month of the regular season? All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbercast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world bummed out that Artie Moreno sold the Angels. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and I'm sorry for our Orange County ball fans, but that was tremendous content.
That's one way to think about it, right? They were giving us plenty to talk about throughout their incompetence during the Artie Moreno era, which is coming to a close, and surprise, surprise, that is our opener.
It is a reductive and perhaps crass comparison, but yesterday in Angel Land felt something like the toppling of an evil dictator. The vibe around Angel Stadium was one of liberation, of freedom. The Angels are no longer going to be owned by Artie Moreno, the consensus worst owner in our beloved sport. Moreno, since purchasing the team in 2003 in the afterglow of the Angels winning the World Series, led this franchise into an era of unmitigated woe and underperformance. They have not made the playoffs since October of 2014. They have had 11 straight losing seasons, 7 managers in the last 9 years. They have wasted the primes of Shohei Ohtani and Mike Trout and Taylor Ward, and no longer will Artie Moreno reign over this place, as he has sold the team for a cool $4 billion to Stan Kroenke, the Kronkster, a man that owns a number of other sports franchises, 7 to be exact. He is adding the Angels into his the final Infinity Stone, perhaps. This valuation of $4 billion surpasses the Padres sale. That was at $3.9 billion. Is the most expensive purchase of a baseball franchise of all time. There is so much to get to here. Jordan, where do you want to leap in?
Yeah, I mean, you know, his reputation. I think what's so funny and like straightforward about this is like if you essentially knew nothing about Artie Moreno or how he was going about it, and all you looked at was just what was happening on the field. You knew nothing about how he was running his business. You knew nothing about the shortcuts he was taking or the lack of investment in baseball operations, whatever. It's kind of really simple. He bought the team right after they won the World Series, and since then, they have been very, very, very bad. And I think that we should note that for a brief while there, they were still quite good. I mean, they made the postseason 5 out of 6 years from 2004 to 2009. And then once Artie really started to cook, once he started, you know, handing out huge contracts and then spending essentially zero money on anything else, once he started shuffling through baseball ops heads who are shuffling through managers and all these things, while also having a couple generational talents roll through your doors, they have just been so bad. And to be this bad for so long, while also being in or at least near Los Angeles, is what separates him, right? And what puts him along in the group of the Wilpons and some of the owners who have had, in theory, the resources and the opportunity in these big markets, and why it is a slightly different conversation, a different sell the team genre than some of the smaller markets that we can maybe get into later. But like I said, it's kind of really simple, and why when this news comes out yesterday and people are going to talk to people who are on the Angels, even the Mike Trouts and the Zach Nettos who have an affection and a loyalty and appreciation for Artie Moreno and the Angels, what are they going to say? That it's been going well? They've lost so much. They have the longest drought in the league, which should not be possible for a team that is spending this much money. And so whatever warm, fuzzy feelings that Mike Trout has, even he's saying, yeah, this was probably needed. We are all very excited. And so it's kind of really simple when you actually think about why it was so bad. I mean, we've been reading about that for years. And why that's important is just like how much better it can get potentially very quickly. We can get to the Stan Kroenke of it all. But when you reflect back at how it got this bad, in some ways, it is that simple. Like when you lose this much, this many years in a row, it's like everyone's going to be is going to say, this is great. We're something new.
It was in many different respects, Moreno's tenure was a grand squandering, a squandering of Trout and Ohtani's peak, a squandering of money spent on free agents and not on infrastructure, and a squandering of a geographic advantage that was never fully capitalized on. There are a lot of people that live in Orange County. A lot of people come to these games, even still with the team being bad. They put butts in seats, or at least did really before the pandemic. And then there's the squandering of the amount of players that are from this area. They should be attracting, like, the number of dudes that are from Orange County. I would imagine if you go by county, Jordan, it's probably one or two or three in the country of producing big leaguers. Cole, sure. Skeens, whatever. Like, they should be roping these dudes in, and it should be a selling point. And that was the case for a little bit. But it definitely trended downwards in recent years as everyone in the world knew that this was an operation that was not being run optimally. And so that's what I think about for Artie. And my intro about Artie Moreno and kind of, I will miss the tomfoolery. I think Moreno really is the last of his kind in this way, the last owner that is operating so cluelessly, who became such a villain to this extent. You know what I mean? Like, I think that there are some comparisons to be drawn with what has been going on in Colorado and what is currently going on in Houston with Jim Crane kind of sticking his nose into baseball ops. But Jim Crane has a World Series. He has two. He built the Astros into what they are.
They've won the most, or at least over the past
decade.
And
so there's no...
What are you going to say?
There might be frustration, but there's no disdain. Sure. And I think the attitude in Colorado is more of like ambivalence, right? But this was anger. He was a villain. He was sports evil. And we saw that kind of come to fruition this year as fans in Anaheim chanted, sell the team all season long. And to me, Jordan, that is why I love this story. In our world, in our modern, exhausting, evil world, very rarely does it feel as if the little guy, the people, the community can have their voices heard and have those desires acted upon. Do I believe that Artie Moreno sat in his perch and looked out to the shirtless nut jobs chanting sell the team and said, you know what? I should sell the team. No, I don't think that was the catalyst. I don't care. Those people got what they wanted. They got their dreams fulfilled. And in a time when there are very few reasons to look at the news and smile, this is a story. That part of this development, to me, is so fulfilling. Can you imagine the people that are out there chanting sell the team every day to go there last night and to chant goodbye Art? Like the joy, the sports joy that must bring is the hope. And like, they have not accomplished anything. They have not taken any steps forward. This has been a day, but Angels fans are waking up today happier than when they woke up yesterday. And that's sort of the whole point of living, isn't it?
Yeah, you put it that way. It's, I think that's well said. I think another important context is, and by the way, I mean, yes, I'm sure there among the Tarps Off crowd are some true lifelong Angels fans. I'm also sure there are a bunch of guys, you know, who go to Long Beach State who are like, this looks fun. I'm going to go get drunk and take my shirt off and yell, sell the team. But the point is, the Angels fan base is a lot of people. The Angels organization has a lot of people that has been there for a while that would like to see things change. The other important context that makes this all the sweeter and the rush of excitement is that this kind of came out of nowhere. It did and it didn't, right? Let's recall that we had a head fake a few years ago when Artie Moreno announced he was ready to sell the team. And we've had a few versions of this. This just happened with the Twins, too. And you saw what happened when they took it off the market. And everyone's like, no. And the Nats. We'll use that as – we'll come back to that because that is related to some bigger baseball business conversations. But there was a moment where it was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's happening. It's happening. It's happening. Oh no.
Psych.
We're stuck. We're stuck. And what's happened since then? They've kept losing and it hasn't gotten any better. I will say, though – that while I don't think this signaled to us that Artie was about to sell the team, the firing of Perry Minassian, the hiring of John Mozeliak, that Molly Jolly, shout out Molly Jolly, what a Molly Jolly day in Orange County. Hello.
Big Molly Jolly day. Molly Jolly, for context, new team president, yes. The longtime team president before.
But she's been there for
John
a long time.
Carpino.
Right.
Yes, but there was a change in terms of leadership this season in multiple ways.
Now, did that signal that Artie was working to actually finally get out? Maybe, maybe not. Well, I'm sure we'll get more reporting on that. The point is that alone also started to instill some amount of hope. Okay, they treated the deadline a little bit more like a normal baseball team. There were some signs where it was like, maybe, even if Artie's still here, maybe John Mozeliak can start hiring the right people and we can maybe start to move in the right direction, even if Artie's still around. And yet, even within that optimism, everyone would still always land on, but if Artie's still here, how much can we really hope? And instead,
that was more hopium than hope. It was more facade than real. Like it was more cope than hope, I guess is
it
what
was
I would
something.
Say. This
something
is real
seemed
hope.
To be
this
changing,
is real hope.
But this is, yes.
And,
yes.
And part of the reason that this is real hope is that they are not being bought by some schlub, okay?
Good transition.
It does not seem as if Stan Kroenke is leveraging over $1.2 billion in insurance company money to buy the Angels.
Let's hope not. Let's not go blindly defending our favorite billionaires.
Sure.
But I hear you, yes.
Stan Kroenke seems pretty liquid at this moment. Who is Stan Kroenke? Jordan, do you know Stan Kroenke's given name?
I found out yesterday. I certainly didn't know before yesterday.
Enos Stanley Kroenke was born in Columbia, Missouri, at a time when the St. Louis Cardinals ruled the world. He is named after Enos Slaughter and Stan Musial. Okay? This is a man with baseball in his name. And yet, an MLB franchise has been the only thing he hasn't owned in sports, and he finishes it up now. Here are the things that Stan Kroenke is in charge of, all right? The Colorado Avalanche, the Colorado Mammoth, that is a lacrosse team, the Colorado Rapids, that is a soccer team, the Denver Nuggets, that is a hoop franchise, the Los Angeles Rams, Arsenal, and Arsenal's women's team. Arsenal, who won the Premier League last year. The Avalanche, Nuggets, and Rams have all won during Stan Kroenke's tenure. I cannot speak to the Colorado Mammoth and their history of championship success with all due respect to the National Lacrosse League. The reason I am bringing all this up is that Stan Kroenke, at least in terms of results, appears to be a man that knows what he is doing. Now, if you ask various fans of these various franchises, you might get different answers. For a long time, Arsenal supporters did not like this guy. he was seen as something of an absent character whose control of the team had led to a downturn in the history of a once great organization. That has changed somewhat in the context, in the afterglow of them winning the whole thing last season. If you ask Rams fans, they freaking love this guy because he took team out of St. Louis. St. Louisans do not like Stan Kroenke, understandably. Built a beautiful stadium in Inglewood, hired Sean McVay, and won a Super Bowl and turned the Rams into this star-studded contender, into this football franchise that Los Angeles for a long time weirdly didn't have. What does that mean for the Angels? It's tough to say. It is better that he is entering this with a track record than not.
Yeah, and that's just right. It's the flip side of how I began this conversation. Oh, okay, the guy that's won in all these leagues is coming in for the guy that has the longest playoff drought? Cool. You don't have to tell me anything else. I don't think that's... If I'm, yeah, I'm a sports fan that would like to see the Angels win baseball games, that's at least something. Now, the road to get there in baseball in particular, as we know, is a much more complicated one because of the current depth deficit that the Angels have in a lot of respects, the infrastructure that they lack in a lot of ways. This is, could be a while. You could also say this shouldn't be that hard if you have competence in a market this big with a payroll that is pretty large and you do still have some really good players, that why can't they get this going in the right direction as soon as next year or the year after? So it's not hard to talk yourself into this getting turned around a lot faster. Now, what happens with baseball ops? What happens with John Mozeliak? Sure, that's going to have a lot to do with it in terms of our perception of the Angels' chances of competing anytime soon. More than, okay, is Stan Kroenke going to be spending? I think this is also going to be interesting, and this is where we could bring in the CBA talks and what does the business of baseball look like, because he's been operating, and I don't know how much he's been spending at Arsenal relative to other football clubs, but
enough.
This is going to be a different assignment, right, than the NBA where you have a cap and the NFL where you have a cap. So do we expect him, let's say we get a new CBA and there's no salary cap, but there's still harsh luxury tax penalties. Okay, is Stan Kroenke going to be, you know, up there with the Mets and the Dodgers and the Yankees? Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? The point is it's really not about, first of all, it's not like he won't have the money. The guy is going to have the capital to spend if he wants to spend it on the Angels. But we don't know anything about that, just the same way, same thing we said about the new Padres owners. We have no idea their spending habits. But the winning habits, the trust in the people who actually know the sport to not meddle, like, those traits that he has seemingly exhibited at these other stops, that's exactly what you want to hear. It's really that's straightforward.
One last kind of Kroenke forward point. Kroenke is not, I mean, I can't speak to his health and vitality. He is not a spring chicken. He is just 1 year, not even a year younger than Artie. Kroenke's 79, Artie is 80. And so some of the narrative about Artie was like, well, you know, he's getting up there. He wants to maybe get out. The Kroenke family, the Kroenke operation purchasing the Angels is not just Stan Kroenke. It's also his son, Josh Kroenke, who, importantly, you know who his mom is? You know who Kroenke's wife is?
Yeah, there's some good money.
Okay. So Kroenke's wife is Ann Walton, who is a member of the Walton family, the founders of Walmart and one of the richest families in the world. And so it is not just like when we're talking about, oh, Stan Kroenke passes Steve Cohen as the richest owner in the sport. Like, yes, but it's not as if these people are not like you and I. It's not like there's one bank account and that's all of his money, right? This is a far-ranging, wide-reaching operation that includes a lot of coin. And I think that is a reason to feel optimistic. Money is going to flow into the Angels as we move forward. Jordan, what is that face?
I just had this thought, and I'm sure this is something that if you're in Denver, you're like a Rockies fan.
Like, why don't you buy this team?
Like, hey, it's Stan, right here. Can you come save the Rockies? You know, you've already done it with the Avs. And I mean, I have to imagine that that's at least something he's considered, and that has more to do with the Monforts than it does Stan Kroenke. But anyway, I just think that that's funny.
That is very funny. Let's spin it forward. Yes, so let's talk about the business. Let's talk about a hash Cone Resnick, the business of baseball. So here's the deal.
Let's do that. Wow. What a reference. Let's do that. And then I want to have one more ownership conversation, and then we'll take
sure.
So go ahead.
Okay. It is tougher, more difficult now in the context of Kroenke dishing out $4 billion and the Padres new owners dishing out 3.9 for MLB owners to argue in the upcoming negotiations that franchise values are going down or are somehow capped by the lack of a salary cap. The sport feels as if it is in a pretty healthy place. Already sold the team now, in part because he got a number that he was happy and comfortable with, which was not the case a couple of years ago. And it tells us that the sport is in a healthier place. I am more interested in how the lockout will impact the sale, like when it will get completed, just as much as I guess as I am, how will the sale impact the lockout? The Kroenke group's willingness to hop in despite all of the uncertainty tells me that at the base level, the business model is strong and it is sound and that our sport is in a good place. I think anything else to say about the business of baseball before I talk about what this means for the future of the Angels specifically?
Oh, no. Finish on the Angels and then I'll bring it back. So go ahead.
Sure. Is the team going to stay? What does this mean for the site, for the land, for the next 10 to 20 years of Angel baseball? So there is at least some buzz about Kroenke moving the team elsewhere in Southern California. He built SoFi Stadium where the Rams play in Inglewood. The Intuit Dome where the Clippers play is right there. The Forum where the Lakers used to play is right there. There is space in theory to build a baseball stadium in that general area. That would require a bunch of loops and it would be moving the team out of Orange County. And like, there's a lot that goes into that, but it is at the very least like in the realm of some possibility. More likely, however, is a refurbishing, a renovation, a remodeling, or a complete new stadium build going on near the original site. What's important to understand, Kroenke did not buy the land on the stadium. And the stadium is surrounded by this savanna of parking lots, but there is space there to build a Braves-style battery real estate project. Kroenke is a real estate person. That is how he made his money. He's certainly looking at this as, in part, a real estate deal. I think the team could either renovate the crap out of Angel Stadium and build around it, or... You know what, Jordan? You have space to do what they did at like Citi Field or at Busch Stadium, where you just build the stadium in the parking lot while you're still playing in the other stadium, and you do Texas. A build and tear down at the same time. Texas. There is only 6 years left on the stadium lease. There's a lot of flexibility here. I would expect this team to stay in Orange County. I think the Kroenke group views this as its own unique market that is separate from Los Angeles. But the Angels, this is a fact, the Angels will not be playing in Angel Stadium as it is currently constructed and situated and looks in 10 years the way it looks today. Like, that is not happening. That is a fact. There is no way that Kroenke will allow the status quo to endure in the way that Moreno has. He is too good of a businessman and has too much of a track record doing otherwise for this to remain the way it has been.
Yeah, and I have to imagine Kroenke's, and this is where like I really need to catch up and get a little bit more educated on the relationship, because obviously I can talk about the baseball and the Angels, whatever, but the Artie Moreno relationship with the city, with the mayor, with the town, like that has been
like the name change
subplot
stuff
the whole time. Yeah. And so that is what I am curious about, to your point, how that now changes. I have to imagine Kroenke has a better reputation in the area. Maybe I'm wrong, but that should help the efforts in that respect. Okay, last thing we have to talk about here. Then we're going to take a break and bring in a special guest with some exciting news. Is now, okay, so sell the team, sell the team. He did it. He sold the team. I do wonder, did someone follow my advice, my idea? Did someone find Stan Kroenke and chant buy the team? Because this has been my point all along. It's not just telling them to sell. You have to find someone that's going to buy it. We have to be motivating the billionaires who seem a little more competent to buy the team. Buy the team. Buy the team. And he did it. Which brings me to my last question.
Like they did Angels fans going to like Arsenal games and chanting buy the team.
Exactly. Or the Rams. A little more convenient. They're going to Colorado Mammoth games. Yeah, Mammoth games, which I'm sure Kroenke's at. Sure, Kroenke's at every Mammoth game. Maybe he is.
I got to learn more about the Mammoth. Slandering. I'm sorry. Sorry to the Mammoth fans out there.
Okay. The obvious question. Okay. So we've had a lot of ownership changes over the last half decade. Some of them have been greeted with, oh my God, we're free. You know, Wilpon, sell the Mets. Just think about it. To me, that's the closest comparison to just like the reaction from the fans. And I think since then we've seen that, you know, how's it been, Mets fans? I guess it's been better in some respects and obviously not in others. There are still fans around the country chanting sell the team at certain owners. I would say that the sell the team kind of title belt, the belt like who's got it right now, to me, the answer is weirdly still John Fisher, but he had left so that he didn't have to hear it anymore. So like in terms of who has still the most fan animosity, it's John Fisher. But unfortunately, that's now in a very depressing way in the past. However, there are still several other owners that are really hearing it right now. Now, are there any others quite like Artie Moreno? Not really. I don't really see anyone else. I guess you could put the Lerners in that category, kind of. But again, they won a World Series. And yes, they've been really bad for a long time. But they have spent money and maybe haven't spent money in ways that people want. But really, you're looking at, I guess the Mariners maybe fall in this conversation to some degree. Teams with like high-ish payrolls that have been, in some ways, frustrating and incompetent, but also in some ways the Mariners have had the most successful stretch in their franchise history over the last 5 years. So it's like, okay, well, I totally understand fans being frustrated, but it's a little different. And that's why if we are thinking about who really is at the top here, it's Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. And I think those are the franchises that have accomplished the least. We're just talking on the field. Even before we talk about how much money they're spending or not spending, they have accomplished the least in Major League Baseball over the last 2-3 decades. It is the Pirates. It is the Reds. Frankly, it's not even close at this point. And I mention that because not only the fan sentiment and what those fans have been dealing with, once again, disappointing seasons for both of those teams, Pirates in particular, after seemingly having some hope. I mention it because is there a number that the Castellinis or Bob Nutting can now get to, because it's a very different market, right? It's, you can understand why someone wants to pay a ton of money for the Padres or pay a ton of money for the Angels. Does that individual exist to get the, and or now are Bob Nutting or Castellini even thinking about selling? It doesn't seem like really. But I do wonder, as we continue to have these conversations, does this become more viable? And then obviously what happens with the CBA, does it make it more attractive for rich people to want to buy a baseball team? So that's kind of the big things that I'm thinking about. Let us know what other ownership groups you're thinking maybe have the sell the team crown. Because to me, Pittsburgh and Cincinnati are way ahead. Because you could look at other small markets like Cleveland. I hear it all the time here in Cleveland too. But it's, again, I just think it's a different conversation because they're winning a lot all the time. And that's just not been the case in Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. So I think that those fan bases deserve a little bit more of a specific attention. But yeah, man. Anytime, it's amazing how many of these we've talked about over the last 5 years. And I'm just curious to see what could potentially be next.
All right, let's take a break. Jordan, when we get back, we will invite Ryan Spielberg's friend, former big leaguer, broadcaster on Apple TV's Friday Night Baseball, and tell you about some very exciting news.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbiecast. We are excited to welcome in a repeat guest, one of good friends of the program, and someone who I guess we sort of almost share something in common with now. It's Ryan Spielberg of Apple TV, Rockies broadcaster, and former Major League outfielder. Spilly, welcome to Baseball Barbiecast.
It's good to be back on. What do we share similar? I'm kind of concerned.
Well,
now.
Besides you and I, you know, sharing a birthday,
we're both going to be we're like the Eskimo brothers of birthdays. It's great. I love it.
Me, you, Stephen Kwan, Reese Hines, Randy Rodriguez, Nap LaJoie.
Yeah, we have a Hall of Famer in there.
We do, Bill Mazeroski. But besides being born on September 5th, both of us will be talking about the Cleveland Guardians and the Detroit Tigers this Friday evening with Apple TV. If you like Baseball Barbiecast, you like Friday Night Baseball on Apple TV, you can do both at the same time. Jordan and I will be doing live alt casts to round out the regular season. We'll be doing a little lead-in to the game, doing the first two innings. For those first two innings, let's do one AirPod for us, one AirPod for Spilly. Then we'll get out of your hair in the second. You can throw both AirPods in and listen to Spilly. We're going to start streaming about a half hour before first pitch and go through the first couple innings of the game. Ryan, my first question for you. You have been working for Apple TV now doing the Friday Night Baseball stuff for a couple of years. How has that responsibility, that part of your life, changed the way that you've looked at the sport? Where before you weren't traveling around at the same amount to do these one-off primetime games, your eyes were really taking the game in through the Rockies, for whom you still commentate quite often. But how has doing the Friday night stuff for Apple kind of changed the way that you think about the sport?
It's a good question. I mean, like, I do have the benefit that I've been doing SiriusXM for so long. Yeah. I mean, I think it's been 12 years. So even prior to Apple TV, I was covering postseasons and winter meetings and all-stars and you name it. So I've even though I was doing a lot of Rocky stuff, I was a little bit more global with my reach as far as like day-to-day interactions with general managers and players and managers. And so like I have this pretty robust view of baseball in a way that allows me, because of SiriusXM, you know, I'd even go to like spring training. We do these spring training tours. So I got to know basically everybody before the season even started and got to see teams in ways that most people didn't. And then that really benefited me from an Apple TV standpoint, is because I had more pre-existing relationships than, and I'm not saying like I'm any better than any national guy, but I will say of all the national broadcasters out there, there's nobody that is daily doing a show, that is daily watching baseball games with a team, and then doing a national show on the weekend. So like I do 152 of 162 games, the combination of Rockies and Apple TV, and then 3 to 4 national radio shows a day, Monday through Thursday. So I don't know. I just, the way that the game has evolved, especially in my time frame of doing this broadcasting, I have seen teams exponentially get better through technology, through coaches, through you know, trades and thought processes that have changed. And then I get to like match it against what the Rockies haven't done. And so it really starts to stand out more and more, is that I see how other teams have been doing things for years. I'm like, why aren't we doing this with the Rockies? and they weren't. And so like when I come back, it would be like coming back from a summer camp. And I have like all this stuff that I want to share because I just learned from all my new friends, and nobody of my new friend group, of my old friend group, wants to change. So
Spilly's just wandering the streets of downtown Denver, muttering "seam shifted wake" to himself, to anybody that will listen. Spilly just said, Jordan, to quote Kevin Gates, I got six jobs. I don't get tired.
That's what Celsius is for, coffee.
Yeah. You're caffeinating?
Not right now. It's too early. Okay.
Doesn't need it for Baseball Barbecast. Can't decide whether to take that as a compliment or an insult. Spilly, one thing you mentioned there, the evolution of the game, the way that Major League Baseball teams are preparing to win Major League Baseball games. Another evolution that has certainly happened, maybe that's not quite the right word, but has certainly changed the landscape and the talent base in Major League Baseball, has been the influx of Japanese stars. And this is something interesting that we could talk about with a lot of people, but we wanted to get your perspective on this, in particular because you played a season in Japan. After your 7 years with the Rockies, you spent 2013, I believe, with the Cebu Lions in NPB. And at that point, I believe you, Darvish, had pretty much just come over. And of course, we had had Nomo and Ichiro and Matsui, but and several other role players along the way. But it was not a steady stream of superstar talents the way that we have started to get over the last half decade. My question to you is, at that point, when you were playing in Japan, could you sense that we were maybe, and maybe Darvish was the start of this, that we were headed towards a wave, in a sense, that this could be a talent base that started to really define this era of baseball? Otani's his own conversation, but it is obviously not just him. Was that something you sort of saw coming? Or now that you reflect back on the last 10 years, maybe some of it surprises you?
I mean, no, I did. I mean, like here, I think we always get a little bit of recency bias, and I'm not meaning to like dismiss it, but like I play with Kaz Matsui, and Kaz, you know, Kaz was one of the top position players and went to the Mets, and they ended up, you know, putting him at shortstop versus second base, which was probably his natural position. So I got to see how Kaz played baseball, and I was just like, damn, dude, this guy's really good. And obviously this is after, you know, Ichiro comes over in 2001, and really like baseball and Japanese baseball, that's when it broke in for sure. And I get it. Like, I think when we think about the superstar up to the level of Otani, we can kind of look at Yu Darvish as being like that next wave after Ichiro, because, you know, I go back to 2007 and we're facing Saito. Saito was the closer for the Dodgers. And if you go in 2007, we made this World Series run. Well, there was a split doubleheader against the Dodgers. And in game two of this Dodgers game, we match up against Saito. It is September 18th, and Matt Holliday got the first hit off Saito for the entire year. So, like, that was the first hit. And then Todd Helton hits his dramatic walk-off right after. So, like, I had personally seen Japanese players. I've competed against Japanese players. I had the teammate that were really good. And I'm like, why aren't there more? And so when I went to Japan and I saw more, and I saw how they worked, and the level of talent. Like, I was in the outfield when Otani was 19 years old. He was a second overall pick. He wasn't the first overall pick. Most people don't know that. And so we were playing. We're playing Otani's team. And usually fighters. The Nippon Ham Fighters. They're not. Fighting Ham. It's Nippon Ham.
It's the fighters.
Nippon Ham is the name of the company. Like,
fighters.
Yeah. And then they're fighters. So they're not ham fighters. Nobody fights ham. That's crazy. So, anyways, Otani gets pointed in right field. And that's usually like, you know, when a manager points to right field in Japan, like, there are no bullpens in the outfield, they're usually under the dugout. So, like, when a manager comes out to like change a pitcher, they come with a pitcher. You can like look these videos.
Bring your friend with you.
So, like, when Otani was 19, and I see the manager point to the outfield, I'm like, why is he pointing to the right fielder? And here comes Otani jogging in, and he starts throwing. And I had like this conversion table of kilometers to miles per hour. And I'm like looking at it because he's throwing up on the board and I'm seeing like 155s and 156s. I'm like, how fast is that? He was throwing every bit of 97, 98. And most guys, their average fastball was like 92, 93 maybe. So he broke my conversion table. And that was the first time I saw Ohtani like as a pitcher because he was hitting seventh playing right field. So when I came back from Japan, I literally told the Rockies, I was like, you got to get some connections to Japan because the players there are so much better than you think. It is better than AAA baseball. The major league team has probably six or seven major league players on every team. There's probably 50 to maybe 80 big league players that could be playing in the States, and they're not because of the rules there. That's the other problem is we have, unfortunately, and I blame the MPB, they have made these rules where the players have to be in there for a certain amount of time, and it was like 8 years professionally, which by the time their Japanese players came to the United States, they were not, I don't want to say they were washed up, but they're definitely aging out. So, you know, like if baseball had a better system of exchange, whether you want to exchange a AAA player for a Japanese player, some sort of system like that, you would be able to see younger Japanese players at their peak, like a Murakami right now. You know, in his mid-20s versus late 20s.
I do think we have seen that tick that way just because NPB teams seem to be more willing to bring these guys up at a younger age. And so the clock has gotten started earlier, whether that is Yamamoto or Murakami or even Ohtani. Like, we are now getting these guys at a younger age, which maybe has contributed to sort of the uptick in stardom because we're seeing them at their peak. The last Japan thing I wanted to ask you is Masahiro Tanaka. The year that you were over there, Tanaka went 24-0 with a 1.27 ERA. What did that look like?
Yeah.
That was insane. We faced him. So the Eagles were in our division. That was our rival. That year, they had Andrew Jones and Casey McGee, so I spent a lot of time with those guys.
Oh, wow.
And Tanaka was completely different. He had an aggression to his pitching style that Japanese pitchers don't normally have. Like, he would stare you down. He would, like, grunt, which is a little bit different than, like the traditional, like, Sugano-san might, like, take his hat off and bow. Like, Tanaka was not. Like, Tanaka was there to, like, shove it right down your throat. And I think they went 3-0. I think he went 3-0 against us. His fastball was, like, 96, 97. He had the split finger or fork of death. But he was just – you could tell that whoever got him was going to get a front-end starter. And that's what the Yankees got. I think if you look at Tanaka's numbers, Tanaka's numbers were fantastic. The other thing I wanted to point out was when you talk about, you know, some of these players coming over at a certain time, Ohtani could have come over had he waited one more year as a Japanese free agent, which would have given him a completely different contract. So he would have been more like a Yamamoto or a Tanaka. If you go back, Ohtani signed essentially like a minor league contract. That's the deal that he did with the Angels. And that's why Ohtani like cost himself at that time hundreds of millions of dollars because he could have been an actual unrestricted free agent. Instead, he came to the States. That's why he had options. And that's why he was like 3 years pre-arb. And that's why the deal that the Angels had with Ohtani is the greatest deal in the history of baseball. Yeah. You literally got Ohtani as a minor league player for nothing. So it's
crushed that window.
We don't know a lot. We don't know a lot about Ohtani. One thing I feel confident in is that earning power is not priority number one for that guy. He wanted to go out and play baseball and get his ass to the States by any means necessary. And that is certainly.
How much is he going to make in his lifetime?
More than us combined. And that's for damn
probably
sure.
$1 billion. $1 billion.
Yeah,
I think he's a little bit more. I think he's financially driven in a way that you're not recognizing. I think when a guy's going to make $1 billion, I think he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Yes. However, he could have made $2 billion. Like the deal that he went around offering to teams when he was a free agent left money on the table. Like he didn't even negotiate it. Yes, it is $700 million. When you defer it, it's a lot lower. And in the context of what Soto got, it feels really tiny. I just think that like he, I'm not saying he is, you know, like a Carnegie Mellon, or excuse me, Alex, it was Andrew Carnegie who like gave all of his money away and died a pauper. Like he likes cash in the wallet. I just think that Ohtani cares a lot more about going 3 for 4 in the show than he does about maximizing his earnings.
Sure. Okay. Now, one last little thing when it comes to Ohtani. Have you guys been to Japan? You guys saw Japan, right?
I've been there a couple times. Never for a game.
Okay. Never for a game, but you have seen. So when I was in 2013, when I was there with Yu Darvish was on every advertisement you can imagine. So he sold Guinness. Yeah. He sold watches. He sold like fine clothing. I mean, like if you named it. Like it was Yu Darvish, and however important Darvish was to Japanese culture, which he is like obviously huge. Ohtani is that times like 1,000, like whatever Yu Darvish was, whatever Tanaka was, whatever Ichiro was, Ohtani is that times 1,000. Like we just can't, I cannot stress how big of a athlete he is. Like you guys weren't born yet, but in the mid-80s, Michael Jordan was on, you know, McDonald's. He was Gatorade. He was Coke. He was everywhere. Everybody had his shoes. Like, Jordan was the brand. Like, Jordan was bigger than anything. He was on billboards. That's Ohtani. Like, the closest we've ever seen another athlete to Michael Jordan is Shohei Ohtani.
Yeah. I was there for my honeymoon a year ago. 2 years ago now, and you can't walk a block without an Ohtani green tea ad. It's omnipresent. It's ubiquitous. It's unlike anything we have in America. There is no single individual in our society who is as present as Ohtani is over in Japan. Pivoting a little bit from a player that has changed the sport to a team that was unable to acquire that player many times, Spilly, you saw the Seattle Mariners last week. You were in the building for Mariners Blue Jays. What the heck has gone wrong here? You saw it with your own eyes, how this Mariners team was underwhelmed at every turn through the 2026 season. When you saw them in person, like, was there anything that stood out to you that struck you as particularly amiss? Like, how do we explain what's happened?
So going back to my 2007 World Series team, you go, if you look at the next year, 2008, there's been two teams in Major League history that after being in a championship series a year before missed the postseason. And that was the Rockies and the Diamondbacks of 2008. We might see that this year with the Blue Jays and the Mariners of 2025. Two teams in the American League Championship Series that fall flat. I can't explain what happened to our Rockies team in 2008. We had basically the same roster. There was a couple pieces that were gone, but for the most part, it was the same group of guys. Could not get on track. We could not explain it. It was the same group of people. We still went out. We had our fantasy football. Like, we just could not play baseball for an extended period of time at a high level. And the next year, we got it back on track and we go to the postseason. So it was like, what the hell was 2008? I think that's what's going to happen with Mariners and Blue Jays. I actually believe a little bit more in the Blue Jays finding a way to get in. The thing that's been stark about the Mariners is that they are a homer-dependent team that doesn't walk anymore. At least last year they walked. This year there's no walks. And so when you start taking away the numbers, it was like we knew – Cal Raleigh was not going to hit 60 homers again. Like we knew that there was going to be guys that are going to have some regression. That's part of it. But overall, like I'm shocked with the rosters that the Mariners and the Blue Jays have that they're not in a better position. And to be honest, like I've seen Seattle 4 times this year and it's felt the same way every time, is that there's a lack of energy. And that is such a slippery slope to talk about, because when you're not scoring runs and when you're not doing it in ways like the Brewers or the Rays do, which brings like instant energy and momentum to a team, when you're bunting, stealing, you know, feel like you're stealing runs from people, that energy is gone from a team like the Mariners. And obviously, like, those numbers for Cal Raleigh are terrible, right? 172, he's going to go down in the history of baseball as having the largest slugging decrease and OPS decrease ever by a player from 1 year to the next. And he's going to go down with one of the worst batting averages in the history of baseball from a qualified standpoint. So it's a massive drop off, but I don't blame Cal Raleigh. Like, it's not Cal, it's like an overall team approach. And the part that's frustrating there too is that we've seen DePoto and Justin Hollander flip-flop on coaching staff members, and from you know, like, they went from a couple years ago of being a contact heavy defensive, you know, run saving group that couldn't score anything to going like, hey, why don't we hit homers, be good defensively, throw strikes at a very high rate, and walk. That should help us score. And it worked. But this year it hasn't worked. And you know, the dugout on Friday last week in a really important series against the Blue Jays was awfully quiet. Awfully quiet. And so that energy, where, you know, you can feel it when you're around good teams, you cannot feel it with Seattle. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're just not scoring runs.
Yeah. That is a good that fun fact, not so fun fact, about not going to the postseason after. Can you just repeat that one again? Just because I think it's really, like, really significant to say. So you're basically not making the postseason after going
a championship
to
CS, series,
being in the CS.
Yeah, like, mm-hmm. like, it's not going to the postseason after you went to the wild card round. It is two teams that got to the championship round. So right. We've competed in the National League Championship Series, mm-hmm. and both teams did not make the postseason next year. The only time that's happened during this postseason setup is 2008.
I see. Thank you for clarifying, because I realize you're now talking about both teams, not just one of the teams. Okay, so both teams in the same year, and that's why we're talking about Toronto and Seattle. Okay, that is a wild, wild, wild fun fact. I have Toronto with me here.
The Brewers and Dodgers are in. They're going to probably
they're gonna
make
be
it,
fine.
Yeah, most of the time somebody wins a World Series or goes to a championship series, they're back to the postseason next year. Like, if you get that deep into a postseason run, you're in a competitive window. Like, you're usually pretty good.
Yeah.
Wow, that is wild. All right, Spilly, we have one more topic for you before we let you go. And that is something that you saw also in person earlier this week. And that is Colton Cowser making one of the best catches I've ever seen. That would be true if it was the top of the second inning in a blowout. However, for him to rob Jake McCarthy to seal the game, to record the 27th out, you're trying to protect the lead. I mean, you've seen a lot of baseball at Coors Field. Describe that catch. I know it was against, you know, the team you're broadcasting.
I don't care that it was against me. Like,
Of course you don't care.
I'm just saying that was badass. That was great. And I've known Colton Cowser for a long time, ever since Jackson Holliday's wedding. So it's like known him.
That's
and every time I go to
pull.
Every time I go to Baltimore and I see the cow, I try to offer him up every hit I have left. Like, he's a great personality, great dude, super athlete. Like, that's the thing where I think watching a player like Colton Cowser, especially when you're not hitting, you don't take into account just how good of an athlete he is. I mean, earlier in that game, he had like a tailor-made ground ball to second base and beat it out at first. He was flying down the line. And then on that catch with Jake McCarthy, there's a runner at first, and he's playing like – it's not quite no doubles, because you can't play no doubles in Coors, otherwise you'll get burned. But he's in like a pretty aggressive outfield defensive spot. Like, he's a little bit shallow. And for him to go back on that baseball – and I love like good outfield play. The thing that makes this play so good is if you go back and watch it, it's the first three steps. So he's out the gate hot without looking at the baseball. if he's trying to track the baseball looking at it, he would never have caught it. So this is like athleticism, skill set, technique, that's all those things to make this catch, which it's not just like, hey, he ran back and caught the baseball. Like if he did not take his eyes off the ball, or if he did take his eyes, if he kept his eyes on the baseball, he would have watched it fly over the fence. Instead, the first three steps, head down, takes off, perfect angle, and then located it right before he got to the wall. Like it is such a badass catch. And then when you put into context, that would have won the game for the Rockies. This isn't like an eighth inning
walk-off home run.
This is the Orioles lose. They lose if he doesn't make this catch. Like, I can't think of a
better way. And they might get into the postseason by one game.
By one game. Like, it was a walk-off defensive play that was going to – they robbed a home run. It wasn't robbing a double in the gap. It was a ball was going over the fence. Yeah, that was sick. That was great. And, like, the part that was crazy was, like, Jake McCarthy's face. He just kind of, like – kind of had a smile because he was like, all right, what else can go wrong for us? Because at that point, like that was the 10th consecutive loss for the Rockies at Coors Field, which is a record. So like that loss.
And this was really after a rain delay. There was like a lengthy rain delay in the middle. So there's like no one in the stands and it's like the middle of the night. And this
catch happens at like 12:55 a.m. Eastern time, I'm pretty sure. And so I was not up watching.
Which means you guys were asleep.
Yeah. So and Kevin Brown, who was on this pod not long ago, he sold it well. And you're right. I mean, obviously you're gonna be freaking out there, but yeah, it is a cat. It's one of the best cats I've ever seen. And we'll remember the circumstances and that alone makes me want the Orioles to get into the postseason just so that we can talk about it even more forever. Because
let's play this one out. How do the Orioles get in? Mm-hmm. Wild card spot? They just go on a crazy run? What about
the Blue Jays? Well, I mean, are you saying
the Blue Jays are out then, correct?
Probably, yeah. I mean, there's only one spot left, right? So like for the Orioles to go in, it's Luis Robert gets hot, which is totally possible. They have three games left against the Guardians. They have
six
games left against the Blue Jays. And so the path is pretty there, right?
Billy, do you want to make an official third wild card prediction? Since we've already sort of talked about some of these teams?
I think it's the Blue Jays. And if the Mariners do get in, the Mariners are going to have to win their division. That's the only way it works out.
Well, we will have another team in that mix, see how they make an impression on you as you will be heading to Cleveland this weekend. To remind everyone, you can watch our Altcast pregame. You can watch on yahoosports.com and on the Yahoo Sports app exclusively. We will have the game broadcast for the first two innings, so you can watch that with us before flipping over and listening to Spilly on Apple TV. So we're doing it for Tigers Guardians this week, Friday evening, and then in 2 weeks, we're going to be doing it with Phillies Mets. So very much looking forward to that. Really excited about this collaboration. Spilly, I hope you enjoy your time in Cleveland without me, but I'm glad that we got to share some time on this podcast on this Wednesday, giving us some incredible Shohei Ohtani stories, among others. Ryan Spielberg, thank you for the perspective, and we will talk to you soon, my friend.
See you guys.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Let's finish up, go around the league. The beginning of September is a fun time in transaction land as teams need to finalize a number of different things. There is roster call-ups, rosters expand. They don't expand like they used to when you could go from, what was it, like 25 guys to like 107. Now you only get two extra players on the roster. We have a number of interesting additions. And then on the flip side of that, there is
In order to be eligible for the playoffs, a player needs to be in a team's organization by September 1st. And so you see a flurry of vets moving clubs around that time, whether that's via the waiver wire or, you know, older players that have been released. Trevor Williams is now on the Rangers. I believe Austin Slater signed with the Rays, things like that. Two notable ones to get to. Luis Robert Jr., a very famous baseball player, someone that we have talked about a lot, is a Baltimore Oriole now.
What a strange tenure for Luis Robert Jr. with the Mets. His contract situation was a big part of why it was like, is someone going to claim him? Because he's owed a lot of money for the rest of this season while we don't, he's like almost $5 million when you consider he also has a $2 million buyout for his option next year. That's a lot of money to commit to 1 month of a player who has just been as mercurial as it gets for much of his career, especially due to injuries, but also just due to him as an actual baseball player in his production. That said, I think the real takeaway here is, wow, the Baltimore Orioles are like, yeah, let's take this $5 million gamble. That's not normally something that would happen, but as we continue our ownership conversation, it seems like something that David Rubenstein is more comfortable with than a lot of owners.
This is a big boy move, is what this is. This is an expensive gamble and one worth making. The Orioles, after losing last night, are 1.5 out of the wild card race. Luis Robert Jr. for the rest of the year, I believe, costs around $5 million. To play a month, maybe more if they make the playoffs, worth of games. He is going to maybe not even play every day. He provides a right-handed bat at the very least. I would expect him to see a lot of time in center field. But as we just talked about, Colton Cowser is kind of good like at playing defense and, you know, being a relatively helpful piece. And so it is just a very interesting landing spot for Robert, who didn't get enough nibbles to move at the trade deadline. But now we see him heading to the Orioles, and a sign of that team's financial might. Rubenstein has been pretty open about being frustrated that he has spent the money and the team has gone from really first to mediocre in this division. This is a sign that he is not discouraged enough to close his pocketbook completely. Jordan, another player that has changed teams. Ethan Salas going from the El Paso Chihuahuas to the San Diego Padres.
Yeah, the new youngest player in baseball. Ethan Salas, a couple months younger than Connor Griffin, born June 1st, 2006. Oh my goodness, that is a thing for all of us to grapple with. Ethan Salas was actually born in Florida, but has Venezuelan roots and ended up, as he was approaching, we've seen some players do this who have, you know, roots in Latin America, to DR, Venezuela, essentially, instead of going through the whole American draft process, move back down to Venezuela or DR and sign as an international free agent. And that is what Ethan Salas did. He got a gigantic bonus from the Padres. They pretty much spent their whole bonus pool on him. And since then, it has been a very up and down journey. They thrust him right into affiliated baseball in a way that we really haven't seen with almost any prospect in recent memory, let alone a catcher. He was playing as a 17-year-old, got all the way up to Double A in 2023, and then kind of face planted in 2024 to the point where he had like a 599 OPS in A ball, and it was like, okay, is this guy any good? And you just had to keep reminding yourself how young he was. And eventually he got healthy, he started playing well, and then this season just returned to looking like one of the best prospects in baseball while also still being 19 years old in AAA to start the season, in Double A to start the season, reaches AAA. And it's we just haven't seen really any catcher take this trajectory since I've been following baseball. So I'm really curious to see what this looks like for the Padres, certainly now in this postseason race, and then also just the rest of his career, because I could see us going through a lot more ups and downs at the beginning part of his career, because he's just so young and it's such a tough position.
Ethan Salas younger than Twitter.
Damn. That's
Ethan Salas launched. He was launched just a couple months after the launch of Twitter. and is only, I think, 4 months older than the Wii.
Oh, nice. So does he, I guess Ethan Salas, like, thinks that the Wii is, you know, like Pong.
Like, I remember when the Wii came
out. I do too. So Ethan Salas, we'll see how much he plays for the San Diego Padres. Anything else before we say goodbye, Jake Mintz? Oh, yeah.
Another person that remembers when the Wii came out, Mark Walter, Dodgers owner, under fire, under the gun. We've talked a lot about Mark Walter in recent weeks, but I've spent the last couple of days really sinking my teeth into the Walter of it all. Jeff Passan of ESPN released a very interesting podcast in which he really dove deep into a lot of the financial nitty-gritty of Walter's misdealings, shedding light on the specifics of what exactly he is being accused of, what the allegations are, and what it actually means for the Dodgers. For me, Jordan, here's where I'm at. The Dodgers throughout this era of baseball, which really, in my opinion, starts with Ohtani, have publicly carried themselves as not rule breakers, but as operating intelligently within the rules of the sport. Even as the public has grown increasingly angry with how the Dodgers conduct themselves, saying that their financial might creates an unfair playing field, right? Like that they're spending so much, no one else can compete. The Dodgers have said, that is true. We're spending a lot of money, but these are the rules. We're following the rules. That pretense with all of this Walter stuff is gone. The benefit of the doubt is over, right? The original purchase of the team can now be called into question, considering how much insurance money was used, reportedly, LA Times, over $1.2 billion worth of insurance money. That is a high-risk decision in an industry that is not supposed to be moving risky life insurance. Mm-hmm. Walter is, at best, misleading, and at worst, misdealing. And it makes the Dodgers, who are already this difficult to celebrate in some respects operation, even more difficult to celebrate. And it makes the whole thing really freaking icky. Mm-hmm. And like, yes, we live in an icky world. I understand that. But Walter no longer deserves the benefit of the doubt. And this is not to take anything away from the Dodgers players or coaches or even baseball operations group that is doing what they are supposed to do within the confines, within the ecosystem that they operate in. Like, I'm not blaming Andrew Friedman or Tommy Edman here. But the Dodgers are standing on shakier ground from which to defend themselves than they were a number of months ago.
Yeah, I just can't look at Ben Roethlisberger the same. It's clearly we're still in the early stages of this, and a lot of this is alleged, but it is interesting reporting. And I think the other basic takeaway is we ain't done talking about this. So
no.
Maybe we get some clarity that results in, no, he's not in any sort of legal trouble, but he's got some stuff to figure out. As we said, that's kind of a best case scenario here. But it's not awesome. Not awesome.
It moves the Dodgers into like a new level of also of like cartoon villainy, mm-hmm. where they're mm-hmm. just so comic book bad guy now.
Exactly.
And you can just imagine Mark Walter in his lair, like,
which, if we're being honest, like aesthetically, Mark Walter always had that. I mean, that is some shiny white hair that you really see only on people that are. All right, never mind. We are done with.
There was a little Mr. Burns in The Simpsons to Mark Walter.
Thank you for listening to this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbie, guys. Thank you to Ryan Spielborgs for joining us. Remember, Friday, we're going to be recording a podcast in the morning from the Yahoo Studios, and then join us on yahoosports.com and the Yahoo Sports app for the first couple innings and pregame of Tigers Guardians on Apple TV. So excited to be alt casting. Then we're going to do it again in 2 weeks. So looking forward to trying something new. Think we're going to have a good time. Make sure you tune in for that. But until then, thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing as always. And we will talk to you all later this week.